Hi, my name is Joshua Bianco. I am a member of Ortega y Gasset Projects. I had a chance to sit down with Monica Palma recently to talk about her work in Actualize, which is a show curated by Jessica Langley, another Ortega y Gasset Projects member. So I had some questions, but I wasn't going to follow like a... This was never meant to be an audio recording. Like, I Skyped with Monica and had some questions, but just felt like I would go around and try to keep her talking, and then from that recording, call some sort of article or interview that I could transcribe. Well, after talking with Monica, sometimes the way that she answered questions, I don't feel like it does it justice to type it out. Like, there are ways that she says things that seem so sincere and meaningful. Like, at some point in the interview, she says, "I just want to be respected. I just want to be respected." And her voice sort of trails off and it's quiet. And I don't know, it was a beautiful moment to listen to. It was beautiful. Transcribing it, even when I add, "Monica said sincerely, I just want to be respected," it doesn't work at all. So I thought maybe this just works better as an audio recording, even though it was never meant to be that. So, you know, pardon if there's snaps and it sounds like she's in a telephone booth or something, but I think that this is the best form for this interview. So I hope you enjoy it. In some ways, your work encapsulates what the show seems to be about in a lot of different ways, sort of meditation, repetitive marks. So let me look at my questions here. I read about you staring into static. As a way to get in, I've been doing this myself, not static, but like, I've been painting on neoprene mats, and you know, like I cover them with some, they're black, and I cover them with some like acrylic, you know, something, and then I wait and I look at it. Sounds cheesy. I've never worked like this in my life, you know, but I just look at the canvas for a while until I see what I need to paint on there. Uh-huh. That sounds great. I sound like all the geeks I can't stand, you know, but then I'm doing that thinking that, hey, whatever I see will be something from myself.
Yeah.
But maybe something I couldn't have made otherwise. I don't just imagine something and then put it down on the canvas. So yeah. How are you coming up with imagery? I don't know if you're even looking at TV screens anymore. That may be an old thing. So if you are, how are you coming up with imagery or sourcing content? And if you're not looking at screens, how are you thinking of content?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying actually actively not to look for imagery.
Yeah, yeah.
I try carefully, and maybe I'm making a stand on avoiding reference. I think not reference, but appropriation. So I try to avoid appropriation, and I embrace a little bit more reference.
Yeah.
The idea of referencing something. So part of the idea of the drawings is that I think of them as the evidence of a record, as the recording. I'm the device, so I'm the human device that records, that has a bank of sounds, images, emotions, etc. So I'm the device, and I'm the device who releases this information on these grounds of paper. So I trust, it's almost like an act of faith.
Right.
I trust that I have sufficient information of prayers. So I like music, and I like avant-garde music, and I hear a lot of avant-garde music, and I also am a fan of Meredith Monk, and I took some workshops with her, and I like music a lot, and I listen from different genres, and I like minimalism. So I trust that these things that are a passion for me, and these things, these sounds are interest me, are in me. Once that I hear them, somehow are in me. And I trust also that other visual information that I see here and there, for example, drop drops of water on the window,
yeah,
or snow, or letters on a piece of paper. That information, as soon as I saw it, I trust that that information is in me. So based on that trust or assumption, is that there's a moment of releasing these things,
yeah,
there. And there are moments where I think, like, this thing, this sound, or sounds that I think I sort of want to put in the drawings, they're kind of curb. I think they are curb lines. I believe they must be curb. So I just believe that they are curbs. Or these sounds, I believe they break. And sometimes I like to think in terms of synesthesia, although I'm not a synesthetic. But I like to think in terms of synesthesia, that these drawings have certain sound and musical qualities.
So what happens, but you know how to draw and paint, and you've been doing this for a long time. So what happens when you start to make the picture look pretty, instead of, you know, trusting that this sound is a curve and you make it a curve? What do you ever see your hand starting to be clever? Like, well, I know how to make this look pretty, instead of, you know, respond to that sound that's a curve.
Yeah, I think it both. I think
you do.
I think there's definitely some control, and there's definitely some premeditation. There is.
Yeah.
There is, and I think the material, for example, the tool that I've been using is this very sharp knife that is, you know, this kind of knives.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I've been using this kind of sharp knife that it asks me for control.
Yeah.
Like a surgery.
It's, yeah,
like very deep, it's cutting, and it's like a microaggression. Not the social kind of or political kind of microaggression, but it's like a microviolence.
Yeah.
It asks me, the medium, the paper itself asks me for some control and for some certain kind of caution, to be cautious. To not trespass the paper, to back up a little, to be careful with my hands. So the movements are careful. And I do think in terms sometimes of on beauty, you know? I think I come from a culture where beauty is not a negative thing, you know? People in a naive way, in a very honest way, believe in beauty. And although I'm not innocent anymore, you know, I've been living in this country for 8 years, I do find myself truly liking salsa dancing. And it doesn't matter that it's going to attach me and tie me to the stereotype of a Latina. I love salsa dancing.
Right.
And I love salsa music, and I know the lyrics, and I, not trying to be cool, I just really like it.
Yeah.
I really like it. And there are so many things of my culture that I do see with the eyes of, with beauty, you know, that they're beautiful for me. And I'm just not ashamed, or trying not to be ashamed.
Yeah.
Trying not to be ashamed of be like, I like beauty. I like things that have certain order, and I like, I like it. I like ornamentation, not for the sake of ornamentation, but I like the, for example, the Mexican textiles that I'm looking lately a bit closer to, because I've been avoiding the appropriation. I've been avoiding appropriation because I live in a city that already has so many nuances, and people are very verbal and sharp, and there's a lot of like so much, how you say, what is that word? There are like many jokes, many layers, and reading people takes time, and you have
to act
certain ways, and there are so many cultural codes to enter. So I already leave that, and already pay my dues and trying to get into the culture and trying to embrace things. So I don't want to be ironic. I don't want to be ironic. There are many moments in my life where I have to play different games,
yeah,
in order to belong, in order to keep my job. So in this job of making drawings, I don't want to if certainly sometimes I make fun of myself for liking salsa or liking certain things, I don't like to, I'm not in the moment to be ironic with my work.
No, it's sincere. It's like a sincere joke.
It's sincere. It's
yeah.
Like, I have no other agenda. So I've been carefully trying not to reference many Mexican things.
Yeah, okay.
And I've been careful, but I'm doing it. I'm doing it because at the end of the day, I'm Mexican. At the end of the day, I have a father who's from Oaxaca, and I have a mother. So at the end of the day, these things are sources. I'm just being very, very careful how I use these sources. And I also will believe in that these things are going to mature slowly, and I'm also a believer in psychoanalysis, and I've been in psychoanalysis for many years.
What kind of psychoanalysis?
I don't know, you know the White Institute?
No.
Well, the White Institute is an institute in New York that seems like does a bit a more like slightly more flexible psychoanalysis, a bit more, it's Freudian and it's
great.
Lacan, but it's not, it's good stuff, but it's a bit more flexible. So I've been doing it I did it in Mexico for 5 years, and now this is my fifth year too here.
Okay.
So I talk about these things. I talk about my sources. I talk about where I come from, how to portray myself in the real world, how to take care of my identity, how not to sell myself, or how to sometimes fake it to make it.
Yeah, yeah. Too. Yeah.
So, yeah, tell me.
Well, so many things. Actually, I'm a professor here at the University of Tennessee. I'm teaching a course, like a Lacanian course. It's all about Lacan, which is not that I'm an expert or know really anything about him. He's very difficult, but he brings up all of the great questions that, you know, we are trying to ask ourselves, like, what does it mean to exist? So I think we're similar in age, and I've been saying this in class a lot. Like, there's hipsters, you know? I mean, you live in New York, in Brooklyn?
I might as well be one of them. I think I am.
No, okay, this is exactly what I think too. Like, I think that you and I are, but we're actually sincere hipsters. Hipster is only something you call someone else, right? Like, there's irony involved in hipsterism, but when there's a Nirvana t-shirt, we wear that like, I grew up with Nirvana.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, and I think I was reading Urban Dictionary, like, what is the definition of a hipster? And it's someone who, like, pretends to know about philosophy, art, good music. But I think, no, you know, I'm 30-something. I do know about art and philosophy and good music without irony, with total sincerity. So I've been trying to push our age group to take hipster. Like, we are – it's something we're calling ourselves, because it's usually something you just call other people pejoratively. Okay, anyway.
Yeah, I think when you call that yourself, you evolve. You know the thing. You know the beast.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was going to ask you about Lacan even because you were saying, you know, when I see my hand or when I see myself using appropriated ideas or like loving salsa music, you're also embracing that as a part of yourself, not rejecting that and saying like, I'm an automaton. I just, you know, I'm a neutral. These things come from me and I put them on the canvas. You're even embracing those without feeling guilt or bad.
Yeah.
This seems totally against your Catholic upbringing.
Yeah. I mean, when I started using more the idea of me as a device, as a, almost like a technological device, but almost in that way where you push a button and these things come out of your mouth and you know the rhythms and you know, when my father died a bit more longer than 2 years ago.
2 years ago. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's been very hard, that part. We were in, obviously, he was Catholic. He wasn't like an intense Catholic. He was just pretty mellow guy. But there were so much rituals, so much talking, so much prayer, so many prayers. And some of my aunts are very Catholic, came and started praying and praying and praying and praying. And I just found myself just saying these words, like, blah, blah, blah,
blah. The Catholic prayer, it's a I mean, you're just repeating something.
You just repeat a bit. Some of them are so long. And I was like, oh my God, I turned to look at my sister and she saw me like, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
sister, my younger sister looked at me like, what are you doing? You know, she didn't even know that part of me. So I was surprised of myself, and when I talk about a device that repeats, that contains this information, I'm not going against technology at all.
No.
In fact, I find technology so human, it makes sense. It makes sense that there are little buttons. It makes sense that things sometimes, when the machines don't work, go from one place to another. TV static makes sense. You know, if I'm, like, for example, this plant, you know? Do you see it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
Technology makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Technology can do horrible things, but actually it's quite coherent with the way in which humans act, the way in which humans say things, move, breed. You know, even breeding has some certain rhythm.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I thought you said breed.
Breeding.
Well, I mean, there's
So I believe that. I'm not against technology. I'm more like surprised. It's like, oh my God, actually, there's not that much separation. Actually, the machines and my scanner and me, we have a little thing in common. You know? Like, there's some similarities there.
Okay, so repetition, technology. I feel like through repetition, one begins to think about wordplay, like keep me posted. Like when you see it twice, or even, you know, you can pick any word and you say it 10 times and all of a sudden the word becomes abstracted. And then keep me posted, or I totally get it. So then I'm looking at the work in actualize and see cardinal, and then see repetitious marks. So cardinal, my first thought was about the bird. But then when repeating it and reading about you, I also think about Catholic Church. And then, I mean, whatever else continues to come. So Paul McCarthy has this quote about repetition. He says, repetition to the point of discovery. Mm-hmm. But then you can also repeat something to the point of annihilation. And I just, where do you think you fall in that timeline?
I think I fall in both.
Both.
I fall in both. For example, my mother, grew up as a farmer, you know, she didn't go to school. She learned how to read and write just kind of because she was smart, but really she had no tools, no future, right? So, but something she did so well was embroidery and actually everything was white. And one of the most amazing kinds of embroidery she makes, it's this kind of construction where you, instead of adding strings or adding more material to the weaving, you subtract. It's an exercise of subtraction. So that's something I appear in my work too. Previously, the idea of subtracting, the idea of removing in order to add or to discover something. So for example, some of those keep me posted are made in the way in which my mother first works with a grid. She grids the surface of the fabric, usually it's cotton. And then after she does that, she starts removing little parts. And that's when the drawing that is usually a very geometric drawing appears. So although it might seem like I'm talking about the first computer, or first appearing computers and that kind of...
I don't get that, yeah.
I mean, I know that it could be a little confusing and maybe it's not a successful piece. I don't know.
No, but, go ahead, sorry, go ahead.
But that's what I was going with, the idea of subtracting.
Yeah.
Like, what do you get when you remove, when you draw, even the... draw, you know, when you draw blood, when you remove this, when you, what is there? What is it? Is there any revelation? Is there, so my very humble, simple revelation is like, oh yeah, it's the cotton of the paper.
Yeah.
That's it. And it's white too. So it's white. So it references light, references
everything.
Maybe cheesy, but maybe hope, maybe, yeah.
Purity, virginity.
A little, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I get this sort of I don't associate it with those computer things or repetition or trying to be like a computer. In fact, I feel like a constant theme running through all of the work, not all of the work, but some of it is like it's seductive. Like it's repetition to the point of discovery. But then, like you said, both. As soon as you get to discovery, you start to conceal, you know? Like it never shows it quite all. Like it's to the point of discovery, you're hinted at something, and then there's a sort of language of poetry that covers it without being heavy-handed or overt. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Maybe this is kind of like what I was trying to say there. It appears like your work has something to do with recalling an image or reconnecting or establishing connections with an image or with something, only mm-hmm. to eradicate it and abstract it and conceal those images. Can you talk about that process?
My dad actually was basically 100% indigenous, but the pride wasn't really there. He was so poor and so beaten, and life was so hard for him that he just didn't have time to go around being a cool indigenous, you know?
Right.
He was amazing. He was an amazing person, but all these traditions and knowledge were there, and I'm starting to use them a little bit.
Now, do you read or have you read any of the magic realist novels? Like, I mean, the list is endless. I think like Julia Alvarez or House of the Spirits, or I mean, I feel like everybody's read Gabriel Garcia Marquez, or Julio Cortazar.
A big fan since I was a teenager.
Oh man, he's like my favorite, you know?
Cortazar are so elegant, oh. So sophisticated.
Yeah, and there's all these other things going on where you're not sure, you forget that you're reading and you feel like you're at the party and then you think about something else, but that becomes sort of part of the book.
Yeah.
It's
magicalism. And I think I lived it, although I don't like to say that, sounds very...
No, but that's what I'm saying, They say, you know, things in such a matter-of-fact way that, like, she was in love, so she was surrounded by 7,000 butterflies because she was in love. And it seems like you are embracing, like, saying, I believe that.
And I think maybe I have to believe it, too, now.
You're right.
Maybe in Mexico, I wouldn't have the need. I think it's a survival tool. And I don't want to enter in politics, but maybe there's also an element of, like, politics there. I want to keep who I am, and I have the need to find that, and I have the need to believe in that when I live in a city like this.
Yeah.
And also the art world is harsh, and all those things are harsh, so I have to feel this schizophrenia or whatever it is. I have to believe in that.
You know, I watched this movie. Well, I didn't even finish it last night. It was just got really late. But have you seen this Sleep Walk With Me or something?
Oh, is that the Ira Glass producer?
No. Oh, maybe. Is like a sleep... Yeah, I think it is. It's like a sleepwalker comedian.
I haven't seen it. I heard about it.
I can't say I've seen it either. But then, like Cortazar, you can't... If you say, have you read Hopscotch... No one can say yes. You can only say, I quit reading it. Because, you know, the last two chapters alternate back and forth.
Rayuela.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, Rayuela. And you can read them in the original. Although, I mean, I think he said Gregory Urbasa made them better or something. So, like, in the translations. Okay, anyway. The movie is, like, he's a comedian and he's trying to write jokes and then tell jokes. And at a certain point... which I was really, like, moved by this silly movie. At a certain point, he is depressed and drinking a beer. And he's talking to another comedian. And he's like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm upset. My girlfriend wants to get married, and I don't want to get married. He said, I always thought about, like, marriage was what I would do when I knew nothing else good could ever happen to me. That's when I'd get married. And the other guy laughs and says, that's funny. You should put that in your comedy. That's hilarious. And he has this realization where, like, I should deal with myself deeply in my own work rather than making jokes. And I felt you know, obviously, as an artist, you feel empathy and you always feel that pull to make drawings or make art or make, you know, work about being a Mexican woman. But then you don't want to do that. You want to make work about you being yourself.
Yeah, totally.
So I don't know. I don't know. That's
no, that's an interesting difference because actually I being reminded by someone else who I am. Sometimes in positive ways, sometimes in more stereotypic ways, sometimes in ways that are very insulting or racially charged.
Wait, I got to hear that again. You're being reminded?
I'm being reminded of who I am.
By someone else?
By someone else, constantly. You know, constantly people are like,
oh wow. You know? I see what you're saying.
Indigenous face. I'm like, yeah, I know, I have an indigenous face. Oh, look at you, your accent. I know, I have an accent.
Somebody said you have an indigenous face?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Or, oh, yeah, look at you. Or people that, in my jobs, it's a struggle not end up being the servant. So people have a tendency to push me to do the servant thing. Because that's what Mexicans do, right?
Wow.
No, that's so I'm being reminded from different angles, from different places, sometimes in a very naive way, sometimes in very kind of nonchalant way, sometimes in a more aggressive way, sometimes in different ways, who I am. And I'm like, I know I'm a Mexican. I know. So it's not exactly a fight to be to have my flag and be carrying my flag, but yeah, to be.
But then you're also embracing that because you are, wow, that's wild.
To be, right? To be, and I mean, what else can I do? I mean, what else can I do? I don't know, what else can I do? This is who I am.
That's very nice. I'm like every time I'm reminded of who I am, I want to reject it and hide it, and you know, like I'm responsible for everything bad. So I recently have read, I haven't finished reading it, but I've read Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. Do you know this book?
Well, Paulo Freire was big in Mexico. I know it.
Oh man, this book is really like a game changer for me. Because it talks about, you know, to end oppression. I mean, I feel like no one wants to make political work, yet I feel a responsibility as an artist to be making the world better. You know?
Yeah.
So not political work, but damn, a responsibility nonetheless. The book is amazing.
That way we are political. We are political. It's true. We are. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true, like, our activity is a political activity.
Well, I mean, what you were just saying, I feel like, does exactly what the book asks the oppressed to do. So, you are a woman, which is an oppressed group. And he says, you know, it is actually the responsibility of the oppressed to find disarming language as an opportunity to teach the oppressors that they're being oppressed, to rehumanize themselves. Because oppressors are already dehumanizing. They're too dumb to know that they're doing that already. So it's the oppressed's responsibility to find disarming language that rehumanizes. Which means drop all of the talk about racism, feminism, gender equality, and reinsert humanism. Like rehumanizing. Anything that is racist, sexist, you know, is dehumanizing. You're making one human less than another human. That's like, I can't believe a book like that exists and everybody doesn't read it. It's all the answers are right there.
How you run into this book?
Oh, you know. I mean, I really, you know. Like Latin American literature, Lacan, this is what you spend your time doing. This is where all the answers are, it seems like.
Okay, so I'm going to read it. What is the name?
Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Sounds good.
Okay.
Good, because there are things that I talk in therapy too about this kind of situation. It's like, all right, Monica, you felt offended by this thing, but what is behind there? Like, is it your own tendency to be offended? Is there also that people are really offending you? Is there, what is it? So it's actually something I live constantly. It's an issue that I live almost every day. And I'm very, very aware. I'm very aware of don't overread. Read just what is enough.
Ah, that's the problem too, right?
Give people a second chance to, you know? I mean, there are people who never deserve a second chance. But there are others, it's like, they deserve a second chance. Wait until they know you. Wait. So I'm always like negotiating. I feel like inside of me, there's like a malabarist constantly being like, passing information from one side to the other, because I don't want to be a victim, and it's easy. And I want to be respected. I just want to be respected.
Sure. So what drives you to make work then?
What drives me to make work? Well, I have a kind of like a, not exactly tormented life, but since I was very young, I've been going through like intense things, like medical things. And so there were many, I needed something wasn't non-verbal. Precisely.
Things that are life-threatening? Mm-hmm. Like life-threatening things?
When I was younger, I had cancer.
Oh.
I also went, I saw a lot of dead, I saw a lot of physical pain. It was also a child, like a kid's hospital too. So I saw so many horrible things. I lived myself many horrible things. Also the social conditions that these people were coming to treat their kids. So I saw so many things. So I think I was speechless, basically.
Ah.
Speechless. I was like really not able to process. So I was drawing since I was pretty young. So I was lucky to have very good drawing teachers. And I always like drawing, and I find it so immediate, so clean, so right there, so economical too. I mean, I've spent very little of my materials too. Like the production and the garbage comes out, there's almost no garbage. There's almost no waste.
And don't you love that? I mean, you'll never run out of paper and pencils. It's such a liberating feeling.
So good. It's like always there. Like you always can count with that, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess that was it. Like, I think it was going through some hard stuff and realizing that the talking wasn't going to take me too far. So I needed a different source. And I needed a response to it. It wasn't just like introvert and feelings. I wanted a response. I wanted to see a reflection. I wanted to see, I can't. You know, I wanted to see the other side of the mirror. I wanted to reflect, be able to reflect, to have the object there, to look at it and
contemplate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's how I was, I guess. I'm guessing.
So then, you've had cancer, you are Mexican, you're a woman, and you don't want to be... My mom died when I was... undergraduate, senior in undergrad. And I remember when she died, all of a sudden I was one of those people whose moms died. So like in my work, I was, you know, like you're a junior in undergrad. I made a bunch of dead mom paintings because that's all you can figure out to do is like figure out your life in your work. But then I didn't want to be one of those people who had a dead mom people, you know? So you feel like that too, like you're being sincere in your work, but you don't want to be a cancer surviving Mexican woman. You want to be Monica Palma.
Yeah, totally. Totally, yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah, I guess because being sick, having certain pain creates identity too. And it's a catchy identity. You know, it's catchy. You can sell books, you can make a blog. It's catchy. It's catchy even for myself. So I don't want to be that, although it's part of me too.
Yeah, so great.
I use it a little bit. It's part of me, but I don't want to promote myself as that.
I want to give you another book.
Yeah,
I've only, it's a totally impenetrable book. Like, I think it's very difficult to read, but the introduction is really great. It's mm-hmm. called The Body in Pain by Elaine Scarry.
Pain.
The Body in Pain.
The Body in Pain.
Yeah, by Elaine Scarry. I think it's Scarry. And it really, like, talks precisely about what you just said. Like, a body that's in pain is always in question. But when you have the pain, you're absolute. So if I said to you, I have a stomach ache, you'd be like, if I said, hey, I can't do the interview tonight, I have a stomach ache, you'd say, well, what happened? You know, you wanted, but I would, my pain would be absolute. And she also talks about pain as being both prelingual and postlingual.
Uh-huh.
Like when you were a caveman and you had hunger, you had no way to communicate that other uh-huh. than forming language. But then mm-hmm. also when language fails, like describing pain, you mm-hmm. know, there are no words for pain. It's always like a knife or like fire. Yeah. That's also postlingual, like when language fails. Mm-hmm. That pain is the starts language and also is the end of language. Mm-hmm. And then that's where, I mean, it almost makes a case for why we need to be artists.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's where words fail. Okay. Dark Forest. Oh, I just wanted to tell you that I really love that drawing.
Oh, the Dark Forest.
Yeah. I know it's I guess it doesn't seem older, but all of a sudden that was so long ago.
Many, many good ideas came from there. It was like a parteaguas, you know, like splitting the waters. That it was very important.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was thinking in terms of the mind as a forest. And you get into there, and also many writers and philosophers using this reference of this metaphor of the dark forest, right? The dark forest, and so that's a very literal drawing, but that's where you can also see some of the subtraction. So all the white marks are marks that came by erasing, and then the erasing turned into a bit more physical and a bit more surgical. Because now it's more like, you know, these little knives cutting carefully.
Okay, so sorry, just a quick edit here. At this part of the interview, Monica and I just start talking a little bit about being a child and going through such a traumatic event as having cancer. And I just kind of edited some of this out because I don't think it was totally related to what we were talking about. And I also felt like it was very gracious for her to relate these things. But I just took it out and then picked back up about, you know, some kind of joke about needing trauma to be an artist. So, okay, back to it.
Yeah.
Well, you have no option but to be an artist. You have the appropriate amount of trauma as a child.
So, I guess so. Yes. I guess, you know, some artists are pretty amazing and had a kind of a decent life, you know?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I read a Onion article. It was so funny about a dad who had a daughter, and when the daughter brought the painting to him and said, "Dad, look what I made," he crumpled it and stomped on it and threw it and said, "This is the worst drivel I've ever seen." And she ran off crying, and he said, "I think what I'm doing is providing her the trauma she needs to be a successful artist." Okay, last thing, and then just if you have anything else. The show is called Actualize,
mm-hmm.
probably referring to Maslow's theory of self-actualization or becoming a full human or becoming real.
I think that's where it came from, actually. Yeah. Jess might know more about that, but yeah.
How do you think your work butts up against self-actualization or the plight to become real?
Well, going back to the idea of recording, it's basically passing the cassette or passing the little thing, right? Passing it, right? Like I'm passing this and I just can't do that much, but having the intention of passing this, it's on the walls, and if by any chance someone sees it and and it's able to read some of that reverberation, awesome. The only artist that I talk more deeply about the world was Ben. I mean, I heard more about Ben's idea. You know Ben, I guess.
I've only met him one time.
Well, Ben was talking more about his work and was talking about all these sounds that surround. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Is my face frozen and some distorted?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So we were talking about this music, and I realized that this music was happening. These sounds, these prayers and meditations were happening, and these waves of sound were covering the space, right? But I thought that in the same way that these sounds were happening in real life, in real time, the drawings and the marks were right there as well. So everything was present. It called attention for presence. It was there. It was present. And for also for questioning reality, right? It's like the sound, there are waves, right? You can touch them, but they're there definitely because I can hear them. So that's the proof,
right? Right.
So, well, the drawings are there too. I can see them. I can see these lines. So, well, they're real as well. So it's a very basic, what I'm saying is so basic, but I guess it called attention to the real
yeah.
in a way.
Yeah.
Well, these things are real. These things are real, and the experience is a temporary experience. I felt so good with the show also because it was so friendly, and the people were so friendly, and also the other galleries in the same building were so friendly. So,
I know. It's such a great vibe over there, isn't there?
Totally. And it's something I miss. So actually it had such a good energy. And also the idea of things being happening and also things closing. Now the show is going to come down. The sound is going to be turned off. The drawings are going to be raw. Right? So they are passing to a different kind of... Where are they going? You know, like,
yeah.
Where are they going to be existing now? Like, now that the sound is off, now that the lights are down, like, where are these things going? I think I was calling more for permanence, a present. And I mean, it was interesting to see other pieces that actually had more of a sense of humor and actually some irony, you know, like the little circle of the people praying.
Yeah.
That definitely had some irony, and I think it was important to put a piece like that. I mean, irony is a tool that people that are particularly a bit younger than us use it so much. That doesn't mean that you have to prize it, right? Or to be like, woohoo, this is the real thing. But it happens. It happens, and people use it, and people use it as a very real tool. So there was, my drawings are all like sincere, and then this other piece that have more like humor, irony, and a whole different feeling. But I see it as an important, I saw as an important part to have these elements there. And people immediately were referencing and talking about Strangers with Candy, when this woman, when she goes and tries to join the have you seen Strangers with Candy by any chance?
I know of it, but I can't relate it.
Where the main character is joining a cult. So people immediately, what this piece called, was calling other cult pop culture references.
Right.
So it was always, for me, it was interesting because it wasn't able to go even deeper or it stay in that world, like a pop world. Like, this reminds me of this, the typical this reminds me of this, the typical this reminds me of that, rather than I feel this, I felt that, I heard that.
Right.
So people were feeling and responding in different ways to the work. And I think between my work and this girl's work, our works are radically different.
Yeah.
Responses were totally radical.
That's people perfect. I mean, that's perfect. Like, I feel like I can really write about that. Like, when there's the occult or spiritual beings or voices, then belief at its core is in question. And like, isn't that always in question when you talk about art? I mean, like, do you really believe in this crap we put on the wall? Do you really believe that it can do anything or make someone think? I mean, I do wholeheartedly, you know, but that's really what the show ends up putting at, you know, it doesn't provide answers. It provides some questions about all these things.
And also I like that, for example, the other painter who showed is someone from a different generation.
Oh, yeah.
Like a 70-year-old man.
Yeah.
And I think that was an interesting, I really like that touch. I really like his presence. I really like, I'm talking more in terms of the opening and what I saw. This is not too much what I was in the walls or in the air. But yeah, he definitely comes from the, like, from a different kind of tradition. But he has his vision, and his vision is a strong vision. And it was nice that someone older was part of hanging out with a younger crowd. And it was good. That was a good idea. I like that.
It'll be us before long, man. We're right on the tipping point.
Exactly, exactly. I was just wanted to hang out with this guy, actually. And I'm more of a grandpa kind of person.
Yeah.
I don't have that many, like, young friends around me.
Yeah.
But...
All right, Monica, I'm going to do my best to push this into
400.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
But I really am so happy that you took the time to talk to me. I feel like that was perfect. You were really, really great. And I feel like I have new eyes to view your work now.
Thank you so much. Very nice to meet you. When you come, get in touch with Jess and we'll...
No, I will. Out. I will.
We'll make some food or something.
Sounds great.
Okay, have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.